Welcome to How Do You Talk to Someone When, our second series from Cancer Culture Podcasts. My name is Nicholas Marks, and I'll be your host as we navigate our way through each of these episodes. We'll be covering topics relevant to situations we all find ourselves in. Some of these situations can be difficult to know how to handle, and we'll struggle with them. Sometimes we don't know what to say. Perhaps you, like me, have come away from some conversations and wish you could take back what you said. Or perhaps you just find yourself avoiding tougher topics of conversation. Well, today we're asking the question, how do you talk to someone when they're dealing with depression? Before we carry on, a quick warning, we'll be discussing mental health and we'll mention suicide in this episode. If this is triggering you in any way, just please pause the episode now and seek support from Lifeline or see your GP or a trusted friend that you can speak to about this straight away. Beyond Blue reports that 1 in 7 Australians will experience depression in their lifetime, and alarmingly, more than 9 people die each day by suicide in Australia. Many around us are dealing with depression and would never know it, or we wouldn't know it. Depression is more than just a low mood. It's a serious condition that can affect your mental and your physical health. So in this episode, we'll be hearing from a few different people, and I really want to thank them for their bravery and openness in talking to us and through their experience and sharing their wisdom. Mike, who loved and cared for someone with depression for many years. Chris, who has lived with depression himself for a large part of his life and who's been he's a pastor, he's a speaker and an author on this very subject. And then there's Professor Karen E. Mason, who's an expert in the theory and practice and integration of Christian faith, depression and suicide prevention. And then, as we do with each of these episodes, we'll listen in on a counselling session role play where the counsellor Tracy talks Tom through some strategies in dealing with his negative thought patterns. This is Mike. Mike was married to Maggie for 33 years until she sadly passed away in 2003. He's now married to Meg and they live in Sydney. Mike supported and loved Maggie through many years of debilitating depression, and he really kindly and bravely agreed to share his experience with us. Mike talked to me about Maggie's childhood and their early marriage years, which was such a joy to hear from him and talk about and share, and when her depression began to emerge and come out. Here he is.
Yeah, she grew up on the North Shore, one of four, I think also, number three out of four. She developed polio when she was 3 or 4, and as a result, she spent two years in hospital. Numerous operations to her right leg. The right leg was affected and the right side of her body. She was the most bubbly, effervescent sort of personality. She was the life of the party. Everybody loved her. She was just lovely in looks and lovely in nature. We married in early March 1970, for those first 3 years, we were just magic. And the first sign of any depression came when she was pregnant with our first child, our son. Uh-huh. In those days, doctor said, "Look, there's nothing to show that there is any depression at all. It's all in your mind." Yeah. So that threw us a bit. For the next 4 or 5 years, we unfortunately suffered a number of miscarriages. And yes, there was a natural grieving on each of those. It wasn't what I would call depression. It was just natural grieving. And our magic miracle child, Claire, was born in 1979. So this is 6 years apart. Yep.
Maggie's depression was sporadic at the beginning, but as time went on, Mike told me how the frequency and the severity of episodes increased.
They began with maybe three episodes a year in the early 80s, okay, and got up to about 9 or 10 episodes lasting between 1 week and 3 weeks. And during this time, she continued to struggle not only with that, but with severe health problems as a result of post-polio, where a lot of the paralysis and aching and pain will come back in later years. So she was struggling with all of that.
The burden of feeling of shame is something that people who are suffering with depression know well. Maggie held this sense of shame, and Mike told me of the effect this had on the family.
For the victim, for my wife, she felt incredible shame and guilt that she was ruining our family. Right. And that blame came back to the closest one, which was me, and I copped a fair bit. She made me promise not to tell a family and not to tell any of our close friends. As a result, I quite often had to lie. I became a proficient liar and had severe migraines when we had to cancel appointments or lunches or dinners or something like that. I took the blame. As the kids got older, they recognised the change of mood days before it actually happened. Claire would come to me and said, "Dad, I think the dreaded D is coming back." Uh-huh. And I said, "I think you're right." Yeah, we'd all recognise it. Just that mood change.
Yep.
And so the eggshells came out again.
Okay.
You just had to be very careful what you said, how you said it. It caused a lot of stress in our relationship. And that was very hard because you, at that later stage, not just shame and guilt came into her depression, but anger came in as well.
Okay.
There was a lot of anger and physical anger. And that was hard. She tried every kind of anti-depression, anti-anxiety tablets known to mankind.
Yeah.
She went through shock therapy, uh-huh. which is pretty drastic.
It is.
I think the psychiatrist towards the end, and she had many bouts in hospital as a result of that she had bipolar, which makes sense because she went from the depths of depression into being that bubbly personality that we all recognised and all knew.
Yep.
As she got older and they became more and more often regular, I guess she always was living in the fear that it was coming back again. That was in the background too. The last two or three years were the hardest. I think her mum died in 2003, and that was a huge blow for her. I was working in my own company, and so I could come home at lunchtime and make a lunch and do stuff like that. She had to resign from teaching because she just couldn't cope with that anymore. From a physical point of view, from the post-polio point of view as well.
Mike and Maggie did counselling on and off throughout their marriage. At one point, the counsellor suggested they explore the idea of becoming counsellors themselves. Mike never forgot this, and in 2007, he began this journey.
In 2007, I did a two-year Christian counselling course.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I was invited to do a postgraduate course at Armidale University. Fantastic. In counselling.
Yeah.
But it was really a journey into self-discovery. And at times, I think I wish I'd knew some of this stuff before. And one of the greatest gifts that I think any carer can give is to be a really good listener. It's our natural tendency to want to rescue people that you see are struggling with something, or they're telling you a story and there are tears in their eyes and they stop and you want to jump in and rescue them, but that's the worst thing you can do because they really want to tell their story. And I think for your listeners, you know, if they're caring for somebody who's really in that dark place, you can do a lot worse than just be a really good listener and let silence pass. It's okay.
Finally, Mike talks about his faith and the impact on his life, especially as he loved and supported his wife through her depression.
My wife went to church and I'd stay home and read the Sunday paper for many years, and my kids would come home and say, "Oh, Dad, it was a terrific day down there at church. You should be coming." And we've got some lifelong friends who have guided me but never pushed me into Christianity.
Yeah.
And it suddenly just clicked. I went to our local minister and I knocked on his door late at night. And I remember it. And I said, "David, I need to be baptized." And he said, "Yeah, good, I'll give you a book on it." He said, "No, I need it now." And I was 37 years old, and so it takes some of us a bit longer to see the light.
Yes. I know what you mean,
but it does help too, because when you're in the pits and you've got nowhere else to go, that's the only place you can go.
This is Chris Cipollone. He serves as a pastor in Sydney, which he's done for over a decade, and has been also living with depression for a similar amount of time. He's written a book which I highly recommend, Down, Not Out, Depression, Anxiety, and the Difference Jesus Makes, which is the book explores how an identity in Christ impacts our thoughts, our feelings, and our attitudes towards mental health. It's a very well-thought book. It's a very hopeful book. I personally enjoyed reading it. I also asked Chris where his mental health journey began.
The book picks up in 2014 with me in a psychiatric hospital. That was a voluntary admission. It was something that I wouldn't go as far to say I wanted to do, but I knew that I needed to do. And so leading up to that, I was 30 years old. I actually had my 30th birthday in hospital. And I would track my mental health journey back to about the age of, I would say 20 or 21. That's when I noticed things start to change. I say in the book that I think I didn't become depressed because I was overly pessimistic about life. I became depressed because I think I was overly optimistic about life. And secular psychologists call this the reality gap. When you have something you're expecting for your life, you can do anything, go get it, you know, that kind of philosophy as a young person. And actually, as I started to kick the life goals, and the life goals were letting me down to a certain degree, because ultimately, in hindsight, I would say I was virtually worshipping them and they were going to let me down. Often we live in a world, and frankly, I don't think we know it all the time. We live in a world where we're defined by what we do. And when your capacity on account of mental illness is taken away, your dignity and your validity for even being here starts to get called into question. And so I guess you're left with two choices. You either give up or you are forced to believe that there's another identity going on, which I hypothesize is that gospel identity that I speak of, which is essentially an identity as a beloved child of God. Yeah. As opposed to a father or an author or a pastor or whatever else we define ourselves by. At our core, we are none of those things, and who we are is a beloved child, and that was very liberating for me.
I found this really insightful. Chris talks about the reality gap, when what you achieve in your life never fully lives up to your expectations. I asked him to tell me more about how this has played out through his depression and also in his recovery.
Being a perfectionist in a fallen world is a tortured reality. Wow. You know, it's not compatible. The world is not perfect. And I should have known that of all people as a Christian. That's what, in many ways, my worldview is based on. But functionally and day-to-day, driving myself towards self-improvement, almost to the point of utopia or trying to find it in this life. And again, not consciously, but if I look at my actions, I'd say that was what was largely driving me. That perfectionism drove me towards that spiral. It also complicates the recovery for that reason, because you can beat yourself up. I shouldn't feel like this. Why can't I do the things that other people can do? All that kind of thing. And I think the only way you can push through perfectionism is to discover the grace of God over your life, that you are not defined by what you do or you don't do. You're defined by who you are. And, you know, don't get me wrong, I haven't graduated this floor in my personality.
You haven't arrived yet.
No. But I think I'm growing through it. And I think God has taught me a lot about how I treat other people and be more gracious to them. And also how I treat myself has been a big revelation.
Chris's turning point was when he admitted himself to hospital in 2014. He describes it as an equally humbling and liberating experience. And his bravery in taking this step led to a God moment that has impacted his life and recovery since.
At the same time, it was actually very liberating making that decision, because it was indicative of just how desperate I was. It wasn't me saying I need help. It was me saying I need more help. I'd already been seeking intervention to that point. I'd seen a psychologist. I'd started medication. I mean, I was speaking about it with friends, family, pastors, as much as I could. And it just wasn't enough. And I went to my wife and said, excuse me, I literally need more help. And she had a friend who had, in the same way, voluntarily admitted herself to hospital, found it helpful. And so the next thing, we're in the GP's office trying to get a referral. And yeah, it was simultaneously humbling, but also liberating. And so in many ways, you know, it's kind of like a BCAD, you know, there's a before hospitalization and an after. But also I should say in that moment that there was a God moment while I was in hospital. It was not just my ability to figure something out in a very, I would say, supernatural way. And I'm not, I'm very charismatically open, but I'm not charismatically every day, if you like. But I do think God gave me a supernatural moment of his grace in hospital that fed into these realizations beginning.
Living with and loving someone with depression, it's very hard to fully understand what it feels like and the helplessness that comes with it. Here, Chris tries to explain it to us.
The best word I can put for somebody who does not know what it is to live with depression is hopelessness. I think that's the best synonym that I could come up with. And I've thought about that a lot. How would I describe it? And I think hopelessness is the word, because I think what people need to understand about depression and suicidality actually as well is that you start believing that not only is this day of my life difficult, you know, this day is a hard one. You start believing that every day going forward is going to be as difficult as this one. And I think that's the difference between going through a rough trot, having a hard time, and being clinically depressed. Is it's the duration of the feeling, but it's also the inability to believe that life is ever going to be good again. And that's the real torment.
Let's go back to Mike. He found his church community a source of incredible help and support while he was loving and supporting his late wife, Maggie. Now, he's been running a men's support group at his church for an incredible 22 years. Well done. Using his experience from supporting Maggie and his counselling training to guide these men through their toughest times.
Just as an aside, in 1990, I set up a men's group, a Christian men's group, right. And it's been running until now. The same group we've had from 6 to 10 people meet every week, every Wednesday for 30 years. And I've been able to use a lot of those skills I learned in counselling. And all of these guys have had those same sort of problems of some depression, all sorts of deep issues. Two of them have lost their wives. It's a lovely thing to do because it's not a Bible per se, a Bible study group, yeah. it's a pastoral group. Jeez. That guys and every one of them have been crying their eyes out in that room.
Yeah.
And that's just healing. It's terrific.
Yeah.
That they feel comfortable about doing that.
This connection to a non-judgmental faith community can be life-changing for people struggling with depression and those caring for them. This brings us to our conversation with Karen Mason. Karen's a professor of counseling and psychology at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary in the US, where she is also the director of the Hamilton Counseling Program. She has two books out, Preventing Suicide, a handbook for pastors, chaplains, and pastoral counselors, and Preaching and Suicide, Teaching and Giving Care with Pulpit Ministry, which examines preachers' central roles in suicide prevention. Given Karen's long experience within the mental health field, I asked her how things change and how we conceptualize depression and the treatment of it these days.
So I think depression itself is, I don't think has changed a great deal in terms of how we conceptualize it, but there's just been a lot more research on treatments and what treatments are effective. So certainly that is a feature over the last few years. I think the other thing that I would notice or just talk about is that I think depression and mental health, generally speaking, is a lot more destigmatized in our society. And I think especially in the church, there's just more willingness to have those conversations about mental health. That change over these years is a positive change. So depression is, generally speaking, a depressed mood, right? I mean, just basic definition. So it would be a kind of persistent sadness or a feeling of being sad or feeling empty. And probably right alongside with that, a loss of interest in things that used to be interesting. And there's a whole lot of other things that can go along with depression. So changes in sleeping, feeling low energy. It can also be feeling agitated. Changes in sleeping and eating. There can be, in its more extreme forms, thoughts of suicide that go along with depression. So, you know, it manifests itself in different kinds of ways for different kinds of people.
What we need to keep in mind is that depression doesn't always manifest on its own. Very often, depression and anxiety can go hand in hand. If you haven't listened to episode 1 of this series yet, go back and do that. We go into anxiety in more depth there. I asked Karen to explain this comorbidity a bit more.
Well, in my experience, but also I'll just say, in terms of the research, yeah, there tends to be a lot of overlap between depression and anxiety. So this really struck me that about 70% of people who have depression, who are experiencing depression, probably also experience anxiety. And I think as mental health professionals, we tend to be so focused on the depression that sometimes we miss the anxiety.
Right.
Depression is one of the leading causes of disability in the whole world. You know, it really causes people to not function well in their world. And so you take anxiety and put it on top of the depression. It creates a lot of challenge for people. People with depression and then with a comorbid anxiety disorder really suffer greatly, and they tend to struggle to function well at work or at school or in their family. So, and as I've said, at worst, depression and that anxiety on top of it can increase the risk for suicide as well, because it agitates people.
Yes.
Anxiety creates that agitation. So
the capital C and small c church has a huge role to play in the support of people who are suffering with mental health issues. I asked Karen what kind of conversations could or should we be starting to have within our churches. How can we be better at this essential ministry?
The way I think about training the church is that it's at different levels. So you want right. everybody, if possible, to be able to recognize that somebody is struggling. Yeah. So part of what you need to do in the church, broadly speaking, is to, what you're doing right now is to have these conversations about mental health and to be able to have the kind of faith community, the kind of church where people are able to reach out for help, because mental health is not as stigmatized. But then the second piece is that we have to be able to help them.
Yeah.
Right? So that's the second piece. And I think just broadly speaking from a church perspective, you want most people in the church to be able to recognize, hey, this person's struggling. Let me get them to somebody who can help. This is my experience, but it's also part of the research that Christians who are struggling with particular issues would really like to struggle within the context of their faith. They would rather have their faith integrated into that treatment. And so, Nicholas, like you, as a Christian mental health professional, that's a gold mine for somebody who's a Christian who's depressed. They want to be able to work through that issue within the context of their faith. But faith helps all people flourish, right?
Yes.
And so a person who is struggling with depression obviously isn't flourishing, but the faith is going to be part of that road back, that road of recovery back towards that flourishing. But what's also important about faith is that it also protects against those more intense forms of depression that potentially lead to suicide, right?
Right.
It provides us with all kinds of reasons for living and hope.
A sound theological perspective of suffering is essential in how we approach mental health within our churches. I asked Karen to explain why and what the fallout can be if we get this wrong.
I think some of the stigma is just stigma that we find in society as a whole. But some of the stigma is theological.
Yeah.
That somehow as Christians we shouldn't struggle, period. We shouldn't suffer, period. But part of it is we certainly shouldn't struggle with depression, because that demonstrates some kind of weakness of faith. So we do want to theologically be really clear. We want to teach in our churches just clear perspectives on Christian suffering, that God doesn't protect Christians from suffering. And suffering is not a failure of faith, right? Jesus himself was in anguish. The Apostle Paul and Timothy were under such pressure that they despaired of life itself. In Hebrews 11, we have examples of people who died horrible deaths. Faith in God doesn't prevent suffering. And the lament psalms, half the psalms in the Bible are lament psalms.
Yeah.
And they're God giving us words for how we express our suffering to God. So clearly, suffering is part of the Christian experience. And if we're suffering, it's not because something's wrong with us, right? Our faith is too weak. And we also, if we have a proper view of suffering, we also aren't going to be saying, just bring your problem to God and he's going to fix it. That is a horrible statement to make to a person who is struggling with depression, because I can tell you, they brought it to God. And God in his wisdom, has decided not to reach down and fix all of the problems that people experience. He has allowed suffering in this world, and some people suffer mental health conditions like depression. I just think having that clear theology on why, not why, because I don't know the answer to the question why, but people who are struggling with depression need to know that suffering is part of the Christian experience.
Chris spent a lot of years in ministry, so I asked him what he thinks the role of the church is when it comes to loving and supporting people who are struggling with their mental health.
And it's the privilege and the responsibility and the opportunity, I think, of the church in this space. You know, we are not here to treat one another. Leave that to counselors, psychologists, experts, doctors. But there is something that they are not being asked to do that we can do, and that is to love in the long term. As a paradigm, let's focus on the goal of love, not solution. Ironically, as we love, we become part of the solution, but that's not the ultimate goal. The ultimate goal is to love and see where that goes. And so again, just practicing that consistency, that presence, that validation that I still love you, even though you are not at your full capacity, even though, to be brutally honest, you're not always easy to be around, because that will happen, but I still love you because you are a beloved child of God. So what right do I have to treat you any differently? There is a complementary role that fellow Christians can and should play that is immensely important. It's when we get the role confused and we try to treat instead of care, which are two different things, that we run ourselves into trouble.
Going back to Chris's book, the last thing I asked Chris is what the central message or theme was. What would he like his readers to take away?
1 John chapter 3, verse 1 became the mission statement, if you like, of the book. See what great love the Father has lavished on us, that we should be called children of God, and that is what we are. Yeah. That's the gospel identity that I'm speaking about in the book, and that's the anchor that still holds me to this day. That's the ultimate anchor, and I think becoming a father myself has helped reinforce that. Knowing that sacrificial fatherly love I have for my kids, I am not loving them based on their merit. I'm loving them because I love them. And I think realizing that also was God's love for me. And that is the gospel. God does not love us on our merit, because it might not be a mental breakdown like it was for me. It might be a redundancy. It might be cancer. It might be the death of a loved one. We get all sorts of curveballs thrown our way. And if we subconsciously believe that we are our achievements and we are what we do, we're in for a world of pain, because those things are insecure. The thing that is secure is God's love for me. And that is the thing that I can traverse. To quote the Apostle Paul, whether I'm well-fed or hungry, I can learn the secret of contentment in all things because of that identity over me. I think the biggest thing, and coming back to depression being hopelessness, I want to say there is hope. And I had people say that to me, and I hated them for saying it, because, again, I wasn't feeling an ounce of hope. But it is so important to, even not on an emotional level, but to intellectually believe that the possibility of hope is still before you. You may be clinically depressed for the rest of your life. I don't want to oversell. You know, I still take medication every day. I say very carefully, I live with depression. I wouldn't say I'm cured of depression. It's managed. And with that management, I have light again and I have hope again.
Finally, I asked each of our guests what they suggest we should keep in mind when talking to or caring for a friend or family member who is dealing with depression.
Just remember that you cannot make the decision for them to reach out for help. You know, the way I talk about boundaries with my clients is like a fence. So everything inside your fence is your responsibility, and what's inside the depressed person's fence is their responsibility. Well, their decision to get help is inside their fence. It's not inside yours. And then to really engage in your own self-care. God himself said there's nobody who's exempt from the fourth commandment, that in fact, everybody practices the Sabbath, right?
Yeah, yeah.
God himself so did true. That. He worked and then he rested. Yeah. It's the same thing for us as Christians, right? We need to do the work, but we need to find ways also of resting from that work. Yeah. And in the psychology world, that we call that self-care. In the Christian world, we'll call that taking a Sabbath.
And it's so hard, isn't it? When I speak to churches or conferences, I generally divide my content into what it's like to live with this and then what it's like to try and care for someone who is living with this. Because I've been on both sides. I've been the inpatient in hospital, and I've also been the pastor recommending others going to hospital for a stay. You know, so I've been on both sides of that. And it's really hard because I don't know anybody who wants to do damage. No. And so there needs to be mercy here. And yet there are some best practices to remember. Look, for me, I think if I had to give one thing, I would say if you are in that caring, walking beside kind of role, temper your expectations around time frame. I think that is probably the first thing that I would say, because that feeds into patience levels. Patience levels feed into grumpiness or shortness. The worst thing I think you can do is to show conditional love to somebody who is struggling, because they are showing very conditional love to themselves in that moment. And so when you do that, you're reinforcing a damaging narrative that I am only worthy when I am put together. Easier said than done. You know, this journey can be years, but it's funny. I think the most damaging thing I've heard, Nick, and please feel free to disagree with me because I'm still wrestling with this one, actually. It's that saying where you tell somebody that they should feel comfortable to get help for depression or anxiety in the same way that they should get help for a broken leg or a broken arm. And I talk about this in the book. Yeah. I love the intention behind it because it's trying to destigmatize mental illness. Where the analogy falls down and where I think people haven't thought it through is around the time frame. Because what you're doing is comparing an acute illness to a chronic illness. When you say to somebody, you should go to your doctor to speak about depression, you are potentially opening the floodgates to a 10, 20, 30-year journey. You just don't know. The more you can come to terms with that, the better you can love, and the more you can communicate that to your loved one. I am here for you in all of these seasons, whether it's a month or a year or 10 years, I'm here for you. Let me know how I can be here for you, rather than go to the doctor, get on meds, and you'll be right as rain. I think that's a really problematic expectation to set up for somebody who is looking for hope in their moment of hopelessness.
In terms of what to say, I don't know. Sometimes people just, and believe it, I did it too. I mean, sometimes I thought, why did I say that? You know, because it just wasn't helpful.
Yep.
And, but as you say, the stigma is not nearly as bad as it used to be. And guys are more willing to share whether they, in a lot of their difficulties, you know, whatever it might be, they're willing to more to share it and talk about it. And I just encourage anybody to do that. It's a journey that people will go on, and they will come through it, and they'll see that sun above the, still shines above that storm, and you've got them back again. And that's a watershed moment. It's beautiful. And when I talk about my late wife, the depression did not define her. She was still that wonderful, bubbly person. However, she struggled with bouts of depression. And I still grieve her, even though I've remarried.
To finish off this episode, it's worth taking a moment to consider that depression is along a spectrum and can present in many ways, from mild depression through to severe. When depression is first diagnosed, people will report feeling flat and losing interest in things that used to engage them. Their sleep might start to suffer, and joy in life is harder to find. So with that in mind, we thought we'd set up a role play conversation of a counselling session between Tom, who has just begun to feel the effects of depression in his life, and his therapist, Tracy.
Thank you, Tom, for sharing about some of the things that you've been experiencing. I've heard that, you know, you're feeling quite negative about yourself. You've had three relationships. You know, your working sort of career hasn't, you know, continued to improve. In fact, you said you were demoted in your role, and you've also noticed like your friends pulling away, and it's kind of left you thinking about and really internalizing what's happening, that there's something wrong with you. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard not to think that way when these things happen, and so I just wonder what the point is. It's just easier to stay stay single and just not try very hard. And I guess I just feel worthless a lot of the time.
And you say worthless, and what's the point? That's a really negative way of looking at yourself, and because you're looking at kind of what's happening around you and kind of coming to that conclusion. What's really helpful is to identify the kind of self-talk that's happening for you, and those external things you don't have control of, but what you do have control of is how you move forward from here, how you take charge of your thoughts and your thinking. Because I heard earlier that when you had suicidal thinking, you were able to really notice that and really reject that, so you didn't absorb it. So what I want us to do is kind of look at a little bit more deeply around your thinking and what you're observing, so that you grow your awareness and start learning how to kind of correct that and reject that and create some positive self-talk for yourself.
I didn't used to be like this, but I tend to just focus on those thoughts now and not look at other things.
What's helpful, if you imagine like a highway, you're driving into the city and you take the highway, you'll often see off-ramps popping up. And that's really what we want to do here, Tom, is create an alternative thought pattern and replace it really with a more helpful one. And you may not believe it to be true right now, but when we think about I am worthless, what might be a positive replacement for that?
Yeah, I suppose the opposite of worthless would be worthy, or at least good enough.
Okay. So which one do you think resonates with you, and one that we can write down today and something you can say out loud to yourself when those negative thoughts really start to take hold?
Well, let's go for good enough. I think I'm comfortable with that one.
Okay. So let's start there. And between now when I see you next week, I really want you to identify any other sort of negative thoughts that are popping up and have a go at this yourself. How can we switch it out? We want to switch it out with something positive. What might that be? And if you can jot that down, we can then chat again next week and really kind of develop that a bit more and get a bit more understanding.
That sounds good, Tracy.
Problems with sleep are common for people struggling with depression. Back to our counselling session, let's hear how Tracy provides guidance around the importance of what we call sleep hygiene.
So when I stay up late and watching movies, I find that I can't get to sleep until about, 3 o'clock in the morning. And then I'm really tired when I have to get up for work, and I'm often late. And to be honest, I just want to stay in bed.
Okay, so you're saying that your sleep patterns have really shifted. Sleep is such an important part of managing these depressive sort of feelings that you're having. So let's have a look at some ways that we can change your sleep pattern so that your brain is getting a rest, your body is being able to recuperate. So I think I heard you say that you're going to bed at 3 a.m. I'm wondering, what do you think would be really helpful to change that lead up to sleep, to shift that sort of biological clock that you've got happening now? Your whole body's kind of done a shift.
Well, I think going to bed earlier would be good, and I guess because when I've tried to do that a few times, but I just sort of I stay in bed and my thoughts sort of come, and then I end up not being able to rest. So I think if I could maybe aim for before 11, it would be good. So I can get more hours of sleep during the night.
Yeah, that sounds like a really good plan. And I think, again, setting a small goal, because, you said you've been going to sleep at 3 a.m. for quite a while now, to suddenly decide today I'm going to go to bed at 11, it's probably definitely not realistic. So I think we need to sort of go, aim for 1 o'clock for the rest of the week. And and see how you go there. It's really important to set yourself up to succeed. So switching off, you know, I think you said Netflix, switching off those electronic devices, trying to do a little bit of exercise through the day is going to also help with that. Sort of gets all that stress and build up out of your body and allows for a healthier sort of sleep pattern. And just simple things like, you know, having a bath or a shower and fresh water and just, you know, honoring your body and caring for it, and not punishing yourself if you can't get to sleep. Just, you know, noticing your thoughts, letting them pass, and just trying to put some music on or focus on something else. And yeah, how does that sound, Tom?
That sounds good, Tracy.
Well, thank you so much for joining us for the second episode of How Do You Talk to Someone When? To finish off, we thought we'd leave you with some things to keep in mind when talking to someone who is dealing with depression. These will all be in the show notes, and if you'd like to save them somewhere to keep them in mind for future reference. Depression is sometimes the result of passive, repetitive, unrewarding behaviour. Encourage people who you're helping to focus on what they can do to up the frequency and plus intensity of things they like. Gently challenge their go-to strategy for negative thinking about themselves and the future. For example, why are you choosing not to see yourself as God sees you? In what ways are you ignoring the many positive qualities you have? What's the evidence that there's no hope for the future? Reassure them that it won't always feel this way. There is light at the end of the tunnel. Normalize the challenges of major life changes or transitions and offer them your support to navigate them. Many people experience bouts of depression after the birth of a child or during adolescence or in midlife and such times as these. Encourage regular physical movement and activity. Participate in it with them if you can. Exercise is as effective as antidepressants for mild to moderate depression. Provide extra support and monitoring if he or she is living alone, using alcohol or other drugs, experiencing physical illness, and or going through some kind of major loss in their lives. Remind them that God meets us in our suffering, does suffer with us, and is an ever-present help in times of trouble, Psalm 46. And also do refer them to a Christian counselor or psychologist for professional help. Well, if you're someone who's caring for and supporting someone who is dealing with depression, can I encourage you to seek support and focus on your own self-care as well? It's really important. Organisations like Carers New South Wales have some great resources, and we'll put this link and all others mentioned in the show in the show notes, or go to councilculture.org.au. Well, if you're also interested in finding more about a career in counselling or being equipped with the foundational skills in helping others, and look up AIFC, the Australian Institute of Family Counselling, for a full list of the short courses or long-form courses that we offer in this area. Well, thanks again, and remember, together we can impact our culture through good counsel. Bye for now.